Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, everyone. It is the Red Men Originals podcast. I'm Paul Machin. Alongside me, we've got Chris Pajak, Chloe Bloxham, and Dan Club. Fabulous moods abound as Liverpool are, of course, top of the tree, top of the Premier League. With 9 games to go. Oh, Chris.
That's me.
I could see your face clenching, but I heard many body parts.
Was the sofa got
squeaked there.
Sucked up into my anus.
Here we go. Welcome back, everyone. Again. Yeah, great. We are going to be talking about Liverpool's win over Brighton. We will be doing much more on the Arsenal City game, which is mad to do so much coverage of one of the dullest games of football of all time. But we're going to do that on the Bias Football podcast, which follows after this one over on Redman Plus, where we have a good old look at that. We're also going to be laughing at Man United on their game because back down with a bump, Everton also. And not really back down with a bump, just Everton being Everton. That'll follow over again on the Bias Football podcast later on. We're also going to have a chat about Liverpool's managerial prospects with Xabi Alonso ruling himself out and a little look ahead to Sheffield United on Thursday as well.
The big divvy.
But before we do, and you idiots.
Because, well,
before we do, it is prize draw time. Our club legend prize over on Red Men Plus was this month. It was a signed shirt from 97, 98, signed by Carl Heinz Riedler. I was there when he signed it. It was great. Chloe expertly handled that one.
Thank you.
So we've got the wheel of names up. We're going to draw that now, guys. I'm going to click spin. Can we have a little drum roll? Fred Ladd. Congratulations. Fred Ladd has just won that absolutely fantastic Liverpool shirt signed by Karl-Heinz Riedler, signed by a guy who won a World Cup, as well as played alongside, obviously, Michael Owen and Robbie Fowler and all those good lads as well. Well, Robbie Fowler. This month's competition prize will be announced a little bit later on the show, so stay tuned for that one. Right, let's get into it then with the game itself at hand. Liverpool 2, Brighton 1, Christopher Pajak. It was a big banana skin in prospect.
Yes.
You know, I think we kind of looked at the Liverpool have gotten through all their in inverted commas, those are the toughest games. Haven't got through the Man City game. We're all feeling optimistic despite, you know, a variety of things. Obviously, the United defeating the FA Cup was a bit of a kick in the teeth. But there was a danger, I think, of like going, oh, well, you know, it's kind of plain sailing or whatever. We're generally quite crap against Brighton. So to actually get that win under our belt was massive. And, you know, after 90 seconds, it could well have gone a very different way.
What was he playing at there, Welbeck?
Yeah, being
like,
good.
I don't know how old he is now. He's got to be 30 years old. It's the best ball he's ever hit.
Yeah.
It was an unbelievable strike, wasn't it? Like, it was absolutely brilliant. And then once again, Liverpool are behind and you're like, oh my goodness me, why are we doing this again? Why do we have to do everything the hard way? I mean, don't get me wrong, if we win the Premier League, I'll look back on these games and these moments in games throughout the course of a season where you're like, oh, that was the best way to win it. But living through it is horrible at times, isn't it? But then, but we absolutely battered them as well. We dominated them from start start to finish, pretty much, apart from maybe 10 minutes at the end where I got really nervous and wanted all of my lads. I was screaming at them, pass the ball, go to the corner flag, stop shooting. I mean, just didn't know what to think and how to feel, because I said this last night on a video. I am not trained for a title running anymore. We had last season off. My emotions were all over the place. I had every single emotion from every single title challenge racing back through my body and spilling out like a volcano, to the point where I didn't know how to feel anymore. And then I had to go and watch another game of football where I've never actively watched a game of football and not wanted the team to score. So I didn't know how to react during that game either. It was just a horrible and yet great day.
Yeah, absolutely. All of that, all bundled into one. Yeah, it was a wild time, Chloe. And I don't know, when they scored that goal so early, I'll be honest, I've seen that happen that many times this season that I felt quite not asked about it. But obviously what we needed Liverpool to do was to react to that. And the good thing is they did, and they got control of the game.
Yeah, I mean, we go down early and my first reaction is, well, we like to do this and we play much better in the second half. And that is not a reaction you should have in a title race. It's, we're 1-0 down, Jesus Christ, everyone panic and hit the panic button. And it wasn't that. It was, it's all right, lads, you've got, you know, 80 minutes of a game left to go. Yeah, just build yourself into it. We managed to get the goal back, obviously, through Luis Diaz, which is just a poacher goal, to be honest. It's brilliant by him, and he's on his toes. But Liverpool had a lot of possession. I just thought we struggled to break them down. I thought Brighton were brilliant. You know, the triangles playing out from the back were really good. And their outball in the first half, it was obviously down their left hand side, and it was just in between Quonset and Bradley, and we kind of struggled. I thought Bradley going forward was brilliant, but defensively I thought him and Quonset struggled in that first half, and the way we adapted in the second half, I hardly saw that ball happen at all. And that's all credit to Liverpool. But at half time I literally said, people around me literally said, we've got 45 minutes, we don't need to rush anything, let's just come out with more intensity, let's, you know, take more risks in terms of passing through the line, see if we can move them, and let's just not get angry or frustrated, just keep the ball moving, don't try and force it. And the second goal is one of the best goals I've seen live. It was unbelievable.
It was it just occurred to me, on just to jump back to Chris's point down about Welbeck, there was a point where like Sturridge and Welbeck were like contending to be England's main forwards. So you forget that, because obviously Daniel Sturridge is kind of like his career kind of petered out and whatever. The fact that Welbeck's still there, and he's given us some tough games over the years and whatever, but yeah, wild that was still here conceding Danny Welbeck goals. But yeah, I thought Chloe kind of summed it up nicely, just as well as Chris had, really, that Liverpool had to get themselves in the game, and we didn't really have it our own way. I was talking to Chris on the way back about how to jump ahead in the second half, I expected us to come out strong, but actually we didn't come out quite as strongly as we have done in previous games, because we really had to work for it, because Brighton are a kind of team, they're very kryptonite-like to what we do. You know, it's very difficult for us to have it all of our own way, and yet at the same time we did dominate the game. It was an odd one.
Yeah, nothing comes easy against a side like Brighton, I think that's fair to say. They don't tend to give up possession with any sort of ease whatsoever, and that makes life difficult, certainly for a side like us, in the manner that we play. Even Jurgen Klopp spoke about this pre-game, and he was kind of asked a pretty straightforward question: why do you find it so difficult to beat Brighton, certainly since the Zerbi's come in? He said, just because of the way they want the ball so much and they use the ball, it makes life hard for yourself. So yeah, every single corner, every single tackle, every single bit of possession has to be hard fought and hard earned, and we found that, I think, in yesterday, and that is testament to how good we were. The fact we were able to for large parts dominate proceedings is just shows you how wonderful we were on the day. But yeah, I think in terms of going behind, it's a well-trodden path now, isn't it, for Liverpool fans? We've become ever so slightly immune to it, whether that's healthy or not, I'm not quite sure. But yeah, it just shows how confident we are. We're obviously brimming with that mentality and that belief that we can come back from any situation. The fact the goal so early as well helps a little bit. But yeah, I think obviously Danny Welbeck, wonderful strike, by the way. I agree with Chris on that one. Absolute quality strike. But yeah, if you are going to have a bit of a resurrection on Easter Sunday, it doesn't feel like a bad day to get sorry everyone, I had to get it in there, obviously. But yeah, in terms of us, listen, we were outstanding. I thought, again, to what I said, Brighton a good side, and Brighton on their day, and I said this earlier on, because I think this might have a sort of a lead into what happens in the title race, because they've got to play both City and Arsenal. On their day, they can hurt and make life difficult for any opposition.
I'm always a big fan of of playing the teams that are going to play your opponents first, because it's almost like they get to sharpen themselves against you before they then
that
go
level in of opposition as well.
Exactly,
yeah, yeah.
Exactly. You know, you don't, you want to be the first one in that clutch to play them. That's my, that's just opinion. That might not be borne out in any sort of evidential way in terms of whether it helps. Or but I feel it does. Feels like if they've get able to give Liverpool a good game, then they'll be able to go and give those other. They're out of Europe now.
Yes, yeah, they got done by Roma, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, that's something that you hopefully will work in there.
Mind if I just on that kryptonite thing? I think what it is with Brighton is they want the ball with their defenders very, very deep in their own half, in their penalty area. And Liverpool's natural reaction is to go and press because that's what we want to do. But they bait teams in. And then once they're past that initial press, they go to the midfield and stuff. So I think it's kryptonite because we want to do that and they want to bait us into it. Mm-hmm. And once they're around it, yesterday for me, it was all about Virgil van Dijk being proactive 10 yards into their half. And nipping back and winning the ball from that number 15 in the middle of the pitch, because that's the way that they build up. They do that all the time. They knock it around the back. But it's funny because I thought Liverpool did a brilliant job, and yet I also thought Brighton were actually superb at it as normal. But there was a point where I can't remember. I think there was a fella about five rows in front of me, and they played about 35 passes around the back line and broken free. And he shouts, "It's too easy." I'm like, "Laddies, you've just played 35 passes to try and get round our press, and you're shouting it's too easy."
Yeah.
It's like, because that Liverpool just was so good at trying to get that ball back. And that's the first time I've seen Klopp change the way we play against Brighton.
Yeah. Did he shout, "Hit the target" when Salah missed?
No, but I heard him shout, "Shoot."
Worth the keep.
At any point when we were in their half.
Can we reiterate this on the Joe Gomez thing, by the way? We've ruined Joe Gomez with this shouting stuff, because he now doesn't know when to shoot and when not to shoot, because he had a perfect opportunity in the second half when he drove towards the 18 yard box and he's got a clear line of sight to the far top corner and he chooses to pass it, and then there's another one later on where he batters it into a bunch of legs for no reason whatsoever. There were a lot of bad shouts at various moments during that game. But that's the thing, is that there's a lot of talk, all the positive Arsenal talk coming out the weekend, is how they've finally managed to like turn it round against Manchester City, because Manchester City have been doing their heads in for years. And there's a levels thing, of course, but like, yeah, Brighton have given us nightmarish times over the last few years, and yet to be able to ultimately, no matter how we went about it, to be able to just beat them, and we arguably should have beaten them more comfortably, and yet you can still come out saying Brighton played well and Brighton have got a good thing going on. Yeah,
we had 30 shots against them yesterday.
Yeah.
I mean, first team in the league I think this season to do that. Yeah. So I mean, we've done something right, haven't we there?
Do you think, just on that, sorry, do you think with Brighton, obviously loads of teams do what Brighton do, but are they just exceptional at it, do you think, then the way they build out?
I think it's the way that the Zerbi wants them to do it, is it's all on Pascal Gross, and he moves from one block to another and goes up with the play and stuff, so they just knock it around and then have all of a sudden two to three bodies in the middle of the pitch, and they'll play the out ball straight to that. I don't know who it is, the number 15. Is that who he is? And that's when Virgil was jumping in front, and he was so far away from the rest of the defensive line, because we'd just gone, that's where you have to attack them. Because if he gets the ball and turns, there's a problem for us. So that's what I saw from where I was. Like,
it was interesting. Matt today picked up on Conor Bradley being more front foot as well. Of like the amount of times you go, well, you're getting picked off in a one on one. So we stopped trying to defend that guy and defended the guy in front, which is like, none of us would instinctively think that's the solution to the problem, is to give up more defensive position and be more front foot, and you know, to stop yourself being weak potentially at the back. But again, bravery of Liverpool on display was just brilliant. Speaking of bravery, let's have a big old chat about Alexis McAllister, Chloe.
How long have we got?
We'll take as long as it needs. Yeah. As long as it takes. Just brilliant. Just absolutely brilliant. I commented post-match that I've seen a number of players that we've signed, particularly like internal Premier League signings, where they've come up against the former team and not been quite at it. Tons of guys we had from Southampton never quite performed against Southampton. Lallana, a great example of it.
God, he didn't perform against the former team yesterday.
There was a moment where I thought that was it.
But there was none of that.
Pitch invasion. If he scored there.
None of that from McAllister whatsoever.
No, he's absolutely unbelievable. It's just, it's the intelligence from him. It's the way he uses his body. We speak about this week in, week out, but that is the first time. I mean, he's done it several times a season, but it's the first time where he has had a team on strings, and it's very much just Alexis McAllister. Alexis McAllister was the conduct of every single thing that Liverpool did. I think he might have misplaced one pass, and it was to Harvey Elliott, which could have made it 3-1, and that was about it. But everything was pinpoint accuracy, the weight. Salah should have had a hat-trick in that first half. The precision of those passes, you can't get them wrong. How many times do we see players try and do that, and it goes straight to the keeper, or goes straight out of bounds? It just takes a bounce. But the weight on it was ridiculous, and yeah, he was incredible, and he was incredible defensively as well. He is that number 8 box to box now that we've seen, and we've mentioned it before, playing that role of being a number 6 has really, really helped him with his tenacity, with winning the ball back, and no matter where he is on the pitch, no matter how much pressure he is, you can give him the ball. And what I love is his intelligence, because there were times where Kwanzaa struggled a little bit, because it very much felt like what Brighton did was they were like, right, well, we're just going to put one person on Virgil because he's the one who we don't want with the ball at his feet. We'll happily have you on Kwanzaa. Give him all the time. And Kwanzaa didn't know what to do sometimes with it. And I totally understand that. There was times where he could have strided forward and maybe done a little risky pass, but he's a young centre-half who doesn't want to, he's in a title race, who doesn't want to get things wrong. I totally get it. And what Alexis McAllister did was, when that right-hand side did struggle a little bit getting out, it was, okay, well, I know to float over this side of the pitch and make a triangle so I can do this lovely 1-2 and we can get out. He was absolutely everywhere, superb. And what I will say is, if Liverpool go on to win this league, this last 3 months, Alexis McAllister is one of the lads who've dragged us over the line here.
There's a moment in the game, Dan, when he gets snapped in the middle of the pitch and he goes down for treatment, and then he doesn't have to go off because the lad gets booked, so he drags himself to his feet, and then play begins again. He gets past the ball within like 10 seconds and he just floats this like almost inch perfect ball over the top. And that was just him all game long. I've seen players with that level. I mean, like, we've seen Thiago and Keita, who were sort of in similar-ish mould. Different, but, you know, similar sort of-ish. Supposedly tiger-ish creative central midfielders. And they've just, you know, you can rock footballers like that sometimes. And McAllister, just none of it. Having absolutely none of it, just continued to carry on with his game. And even after that, he just got better and better.
Yeah, absolutely sensational. Like, I'm quickly run that of superlatives for him in recent weeks. He's been absolutely sublime. Like, at the centre of everything again yesterday for me. You're absolutely right to mention the names you mentioned there. And I think a lot of players we've had of that ilk down the years are flattered to deceive a little bit, but McAllister, absolutely none of that. Like, he is integral to everything we do right now. And I think big shout out to Otoo Endo in there as well.
Allowing him
and freeing him up to flourish and show his true potential. No two ways about that. He's taken off a lot of that workload. As much as McAllister is still doing his defensive duties and win the ball back and all that sort of good stuff, there's no two ways about it for me. Since those two have started working in unison, McAllister's just gone to another level entirely. And yesterday was probably his pick of his performances to date, which is something given how incredible he's been in recent weeks. Just his use of the ball, Chloe mentioned his intelligence there, it's absolutely spot on. And his vision as well, what he can see, he seems to see things on a pitch that nobody else really can. You mentioned that little floated dink over the top, the assist later on, the execution of that is absolutely sublime. It's a joy to watch right now, Alexis McAllister, really is. And he is what we've been crying out for. As good as we've been this season exclusively, in recent weeks it has felt a little bit like, okay, we're staying a little bit closer to the wind here in terms of what we got available to us. He's made everything okay, literally everything fine.
Hasn't he had like 9 goal contributions in his last like 10 games as well, which is a little bit silly. And it just goes to show that this is the player we actually did buy, and he sacrificed himself for the first majority of the season. Like, he was heavily criticised because he wasn't the player that everyone expected.
It was a Bosley, wasn't it? It was getting all the plaudits.
Exactly. And there was like loads of things brought up this weekend where like rival fans have put like, why is no one talking about the flop McAllister? And it's like, you actually, from like the start of the season, and now you like watch him, and it's like he played against Brighton and you think to yourself, how have we stolen for 35 mil? Like, that's a joke.
Yeah. I was on the first to say I'd be a little bit underwhelmed by his start to Liverpool career. That wasn't say flop. That's
no,
ridiculous.
That was rival fans.
But I was a little bit like, okay, because of Szoboszlai being so good and because we expected so much from McAllister, but he was very much doing a job in the six, essentially. He was doing it perfectly fine, by the way, but we weren't seeing that. I thought we'd signed this is better than what I thought, to be honest, but I thought we'd sign more like this. We weren't seeing it for the first few weeks. I was a bit like, okay, but my word, like, he is the heartbeat of Liverpool Football Club right now.
It's when like we've seen it over the years, haven't we, when Gerrard's in the middle and every player looks for Steven Gerrard and passes him the ball, and that's what every player is doing right now with Alexi McAllister. It's where is he? How do I get the ball to him? And it was interesting. I don't normally watch like the match of the day analysis and stuff. I normally just watch highlights and move on. But I thought their analysis on McAllister was excellent yesterday. And, you know, they mentioned that Mo Salah had said to him in the week, you need to play the ball earlier to me. And then, I mean, he could have had, what was it, 9 goal contributions in the last 10? Did you say you could have had 9 goal contributions for Salah yesterday?
Yeah.
Because there was that many passes to him over and over again on an absolute plate. You're just like, there's nothing he hasn't got. He's got the tenacity. He's got the vision of a Steven Gerrard or a Trent Alexander-Arnold. He's got the passing ability of those two players plus a Xabi Alonso. He's got absolutely everything you need. He bangs a header in at one point during the game. So he's starting to find out to get into the penalty area for us as well. And, you know, I think now what we're seeing is a little bit of rhythm with playing on that right-hand side a few times. Mm. And there may be a bit more of an understanding with what Mo wants. And I do think there was a bit of a tactical shift again yesterday to get Mo involved in front of goal a bit more. That worked. Not sure the finishing from Mo Salah was quite up to the standards that we probably expected. I thought he was arse, to be honest with you. I thought he was absolutely terrible, but still scores the winner, which is classic Mo Salah, isn't
it? The best players in the world do that, don't they? You know, they can beat you without being at the best. Interesting on the McAllister thing. So according to Transfermarkt, so far this season, he played 21 times at defensive midfielder with 1 goal and 1 assist since moving to central midfielder, 14 appearances, 4 goals, 6 assists. I mean,
that's outrageous for sentiment.
Yeah.
That also goes to show what we were saying about him being underwhelming. I'm not being critical, but during his time as a six, he was perfectly fine as a six. Mm. But we all felt we were scratching the surface with how good he was as a footballer. You move him into the eight and look what you're getting, plus all the defensive stuff as well. It's incredible.
And also, we all had been sold a dream at the fact that, you know, he was that number eight. Yeah, he did a double pivot for
Brighton.
He comes
with a 10 on his back as well.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. But what we'd seen is the creativity of Alexis McAllister and that Brighton side as much as before he moved to that double pivot. So I think we all thought that this was the McAllister we were getting, and when it wasn't, you know, it was because he was sacrificed himself to go into a job for the Reds. And can we talk about the fact that Liverpool are top of the league with a lad who is, how tall is he? He's a number 10, but how tall is McAllister? He played 21 appearances for Liverpool as a DM this season, and Liverpool at the moment in time are top of the league.
Did someone see someone put a tweet out, I think it was yesterday, it might have been Andrew Beasley, about how many games we've played with a completely new midfield from last year. Did you see that one?
I saw the general conversation
because again, Endo, Szoboszlai, McAllister there, it's a brand new midfield. It doesn't look like a brand new midfield, does it, in terms of play less than a season together and stuff. And I must admit, right, if I'm Harvey Elliott now, I'm looking around thinking, how am I going to get into this side? I mean, I play some of the best football I've ever played, and now there's a lad who's playing on my position in the eights who's running the game. I feel a bit sorry for Harvey because he's not getting in front of Salah, he's not getting in front of McAllister. Where does he get in?
But also, he's still only 20, so, like, you know, he's got to think to himself, he's got a long road ahead of him at Liverpool. And by the way, that switch of play when he came on was absolutely ridiculous as well.
Yeah.
But also, he's been a saviour for Liverpool this season at times, like coming off the bench and really dragging us over the line and knowing, hey, I'm a Liverpool fan here. I was a Liverpool fan first. I'm going to be the one to put the hard yards in and get the winner here. So he knows he has a massive contribution at Liverpool. And whether, you know, you can be angry with not starting, but at the same time, if Liverpool win a league trophy, my word, has he had such a massive say in that.
It's interesting. I just quickly wanted to check my facts on this because I wanted to say that goal assist returns probably is probably as good as anything Liverpool have had from a central midfielder, you know, under Jurgen Klopp. And I just went back 2 seasons, obviously the last time we were good and we played a lot of football that season. Henderson and Fabinho both had 9 goal contributions, 3 goals, 6 assists for Hendo, 8 goals, 1 assist for Fabinho. And that was as good as it got from midfielders.
Be careful, Paul. Put that graphic back up for me. You can't be changing the St. George's flag like that.
Oh, no.
What? Yellow.
Very good. But on so far this season, as mentioned there, Alexis McAllister's on 12 with 5 goals and 7 assists to all comps. You've then got a little bit further down, Szoboszlai's got 7 and 4. And even then, you've got Harvey Elliott, but a little bit in the front line, of course, but 3 and 7. Curtis Jones, 5 and 3. It just speaks to Liverpool's midfield. build are the business, and McAllister's only just of late sort of being unleashed to the party there, and long may that continue. I thought he was brilliant, and it's just one of them footballers that you just enjoy watching.
Makes us tick at a minute, doesn't he? Sensational.
Really does. Yeah, I love him. Quite a first half, because I've seen a few people in the comments kind of referring to it. Nunes and Szoboszlai, more leaning toward the Szoboszlai chat here, Chris, I guess. You know, he's not been right. You know, I think he had that initial sort of bursting onto the scene. And I remember going, you know, doing TNT for the Wolves game and extolling his virtues. He had a brilliant start to his Liverpool career. I think he had a bit of a sort of lull in the middle since coming back from injury. I don't think he's quite been at the races. And I think he was largely, at best, really bang average, I think, through most of the game until about 20 minutes to go, when it was a bit like he went, oh, I've got loads in the tank left here. I'm going to start running around. And then, he really started to get back to the player that we know he is again.
Yeah, it's an interesting one for me, because I think he's struggling getting involved in the game. I don't think he's playing badly. I just don't think he's involved in the game. And sometimes that's the player and sometimes that's the team that you're coming up against, making it difficult for them, isn't it? But it's kind of felt a little bit on the player to me. Like, not showing for the pass quite as much as maybe Alexis or Endo or the wide players and stuff like that. So I don't know whether he's got kind of lost a little bit in this sort of change back to the left-hand side and not really understanding where he's supposed to be and what the team want from him. But you're absolutely spot on. I don't know whether it was 67 minutes or something, start tearing past lads, and his pressing's always good whether he's involved in the game or not. But like, I think it's the second goal, isn't it? He's running down the right hand side and he flips in a great ball to Alexi McAllister, who obviously does what he does, which is play one of the most beautiful assists you'll ever see. And he just gets stronger and stronger and stronger. It's a bit interesting for me, because I don't really know how to feel about him at the moment. I know we've got a great player there. I just want to see more from him each and every week.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, Dan, the shift to move him to that side, you know, because he's played as the right side that he fought us all season long. And McAllister's kind of started to crop up in there and look really good in there. Szoboszlai's now in Curtis Jones's pot instead. And it actually starts to tell you a lot, I think, about who's made themselves the most important. Now, Szoboszlai's had injuries, so he's not been able to get that run of games since the new year. It's been quite a broken 2024 for him so far. But I kind of, it tells you Alexis McAllister's there. He's absolutely flying. Szoboszlai's not getting in the team if he's playing in McAllister's position at this point. So move him over to that side and then wait and see what happens when Kerr comes back and see who wants to fight the most for him.
Yeah, that's kind of how it feels, isn't it? And that's been the case a lot, really, with that left side of their position. When you think about Gravenberch and Curtis Jones at one point, when Szoboszlai was the hot hand and he was playing really well whilst McAllister was in the six. But yeah, I think you are a little bit accommodating Dom Szoboszlai in this side right now, because he's not firing all cylinders. McAllister is very much the guy, and he is, you know, he's got his place on the right-hand side, and rightfully so. Whether they've fallen upon it, whether they spotted something in training, whether it just works, I'm not quite sure. But McAllister feels a shoo-in on the right side of the eight right now, and I wouldn't have said that at the start of the season either, to be honest. So, yeah, I'm all for it. And I think Szoboszlai does need to sort of up his game and improve his performances, because you're right, he's sort of flittering in and out of games right now. He's having a moment, you think, okay, now he's back to his best, and then he's not all of a sudden. I don't know whether it's a confidence thing. I think positionally, he hasn't done himself loads of favours, because obviously he isn't playing probably on his favoured side right now. I think when he goes away with Hungary, he plays in a completely different position again, so he feels a little bit all over the place. He can't quite get any rhythm going. I think he's a wonderfully talented footballer, there's no two ways about that. I don't think he'd go from being bursting on the scene and being the next Steven Gerrard in waiting to being not very good. I'm not sure that's a conversation, but he definitely feels as though he needs something to fall back into place, something to click into gear for him. And as for Curtis Jones coming back, yeah, I think that position's fair game right now, to be honest with you. I don't think Szoboszlai is nailed down. As much as I think and really like the balance of that midfield three of Endo, McAllister, Szoboszlai, I think that's got a little bit of everything. It's got the tenacity, the physicality, the pressing, and above all, the quality. I think if Jones gets back up and running and get back up to speed quickly, there's a conversation. We're only a week away from that conversation being a very real thing.
I think there's something with Szoboszlai, Chloe, that he's had to deal with injuries, and he's had to deal with a little bit of a setback in that as well. And there was just maybe a little bit of something where, is he playing within himself? Is he trying? Is he worried about whether he pushes himself? Can he go? And if he doesn't want to be out again, he's had a lot of pressure on his shoulders. You know, he's such an important figure for that Hungary side that, yeah, you know, it's hard. It's a hard mindset to get out of, but it generally felt a little bit like breaking through scar tissue or something in the game at the weekend. I ended up feeling loads more positive around him, and he didn't have a brilliant game from start to finish, as I say, but he ends on a high. So actually, you get to walk away feeling loads more positive around him, whereas, you know, if you brought him off on, like, 60 minutes, if we'd made earlier substitutions, which we didn't, which is quite surprising in this game, you might have left with a bit of a bit of taste in the mouth thinking about his performance, whereas actually he got to turn it around by the end.
Yeah, he did, and I think what we need to look at is the fact that, you know, at the start of the season, he was the one who was never substituted. Like, he was the one who you were guaranteed to play 90 minutes because he had it in the tank, and because he suited us so well and he was in such good form, and he's never really gotten a break. Obviously this injury has gotten him a break, but also it's not a break being on the sideline. It might, you know, energise you even more, but also you're knocked back in terms of fitness and things like that, and it's hard to get back into a rhythm. And he plays week in, week out. Look, Hungary played two games and he was incredible for them. Yeah. And he's their captain. He plays 90 minutes no matter what. And I think it was Bournemouth away where we played him, and since then I just felt like it was one game too many in that period, and I don't think he's ever got back to the player he was before then. But at the same time, you see the quality that he does have. And I think where we mentioned McAllister goes to find the ball, he creates the triangles. Sabo wasn't moving towards the ball, wasn't creating loads of space. And Brighton were doing a really good job. And when Sabo is at his best is when he's in between the lines and when he's driving at people. And he got that chance in the second half. He picked it up and he was on the half turn and he was, you know, taking three players out the game by just sprinting with long legs past them. And I think he slips one into Darwin Nunes, who the keeper then saves it. And I think what we also have to take into consideration is when he was at his best, he had Trent Alexander-Arnold and Mo Salah on the same side of him. So much creativity. We're right now on that left-hand side where he's playing. You've got a Joe Gomez who's playing the inverted and isn't overlapping, and a Lucho who's very much doing everything that he can because he's got to make up for the fact that he doesn't have Andy Robbo bombing down to cause, you know, the space on the left-hand side. So he has to kind of cause it for Nunes, or Nunes has to run around him and create it for Diaz. So he's got a little bit of trouble there, but to be perfectly honest, the biggest cheer of the afternoon was 75 gone, and he decides to just sprint down every single lad until their keeper boots that out of play. Yeah. And that was that's why you're in the team, lad. And you keep doing that and you'll keep your place, because what is Klopp's philosophy? It's pressing from the front. And if you're the best at that, you're going to be in the team. Yeah. So he's got the quality there. He just needs more rhythm. And we also got to think, this is a different level of pressure to what he's ever felt. He did it for RB Leipzig and yet Hungary, but Hungary aren't the team that everyone expects to go and win Euros or expects to go and win anything. You're at Liverpool now and you're top of the league now. There's a lot more pressure on you. And hopefully with his best mate back in the team soon, he can, you know, they can help each other and force each other to be better.
Shake hands as the substitute for each other. Okay, sure. I want to talk to Luis Diaz, Chris. Just brilliant again, and he's another one alongside Alex McAllister, and I think Harvey Elliott's the other one in this as well, who've really dragged Liverpool over the line in the last five or six games. Four goals and three assists in his last 10 league games. I rolled it to 10 because in reality it's actually 4 and 3 in his last 8, but just to make it a nice round number, I went all the way back to the start of the new year. Prior to that, it was 3 goals and 1 assist in the 18. This is in the league prior to that. So it tells you what you're seeing with your own eyes. Is it goes back to the rhythm thing. He's finding his feet. And our chief concern around him was, is he going to score enough goals for Liverpool? Well, that is much more like it as far as a goal returner goes.
It is, and he's coming for some difficult conversations, I think, between Liverpool fans around them. You know, I did a news show last week and, you know, there was talk about Barcelona wanting to sign him for £100 million and all this type of stuff. And I think a lot of people were quick to say, well, you'd sell him for 100 and you buy someone else. And I was trying to make the point that,
were people not quick to go, where the fuck are Barcelona getting £100 million from?
I think that when it comes down to, I tried to explain it, like, listen, if it was Football Manager, I'd probably do it, because you can go and sign someone who's going to get you 30 goals a season on Footy Manager, but it's not. It's real life, and we've got a world-class footballer who's performing week in, week out. He doesn't quite get us as many goals as we'd like, but he's a successful player. He's brilliant for us. He does an incredible job for the team. You're risking a hell of a lot in selling Luis Diaz to try and replace him. And that's what it sort of comes down to for me, is that he knows what we want. And at times he's the heartbeat of this side. Like, there's times when we just won't be denied, and it stems from Luis Diaz and his work rate and his want to get the ball back over and over again. And yeah, I don't think he's a killer in front of goal. I've said it countless times, but every other facet of his game is brilliant, and you would not swap that for anybody.
And it's mad, isn't it? Because I think nominally I agree with that sentiment that he's not a killer in front of goal, except he also is. Because if you put the ball, if you put the amount of times he arrives in those between the sticks sort of situations and scores like a mad, gets a mad touch, like the goal at the weekend literally is such a poacher's finish. It's untrue. But it's whenever he seems to, he does so much work so far away from the goal that he never seems to get injured.
Like, by the time he ran 70 yards or
100%
or whatever. And what I mean is, like, listen, I'm not talking about him as a finisher. His natural instinct isn't like Jota's to get into the box in the same way. He gets into the box, but Jota would do it five times more a game.
Yeah,
that's what I'm talking about when I say it rather than a finisher and stuff. So I just think yesterday's performance again epitomised Luis Diaz for me, is that he's going to leave everything on the field every single time for the red shirt. And to be quite honest with you, I can't ask for much more than a player.
There was a guy by me, Dan, before the game, and he said, Paul, I saw someone on Twitter saying, God, I've had enough of Diaz. Why is he starting? And I was like, mate, I honestly don't get it at all. And I feel like pulling people aside and go, you know, we've got like those mad opinions on Diaz, just going, I know sometimes we get wedded to our negative opinions. We form an opinion on a footballer, and then you just, for some reason, people choose to die on that particular hill forever. But I just kind of want to go over to these people and go, listen, just away from the glare of everything, you might want to just have a word with yourself here, because you're making yourself look stupid. Because, like, what? Okay, if you're going to measure him by, let's say Sadio Mane's metric, he's probably not going to score as many goals as Sadio Mane did for Liverpool, but also he is a different type of footballer. And when I look at what he goes out on the field, and as Chris says, he pours every egg of energy into every game of football that he plays for us. He fights, he battles, he gets your arse off your seat every single time he gets on the football as well, and he's scoring goals and getting assists as well. I just think he's magic. When you've got Darwin and Salah scoring, getting 30 to 40 goals and assists in a season individually, he's just a perfect addition to that.
Yeah, he'll do for me. You're absolutely spot on, because I think the Darwin and Salah thing, and you can probably throw Diogo Jota into that conversation as well, is actually quite important in and around this, because so much of the spotlight is on Diaz, where maybe Salah isn't there, or Nunes wasn't there quite recently, and a few chances do fall to Diaz in a tight game and he doesn't put them away. That's when people start going, he's not this, he's not, and people start harking back to Sadio Mane, because he isn't that guy. But you're right, he's incredible. He works so hard, he's tireless in his effort, he's got bags and bags of quality. We all seen that on display with that mad run against City the other week when he left Kyle Walker and Rodri for dead two or three times. Like, he has got everything. We've seen it since day one. He hit the ground running as a Liverpool player. He has some issues, might be too strong. He has some drawbacks, I think it's fair to say, when it comes to those numbers. He's improving on them as we speak, which is brilliant. I thought the goal yesterday was a real sort of, I want to see more of that, because that being on the move, being that striker, that poacher's instinct, that boss, I love all that. And he's done it a few times, but there are times whereby he can leave you a little bit frustrated, leaves you wanting more. But I think the people who do, the detractors and the naysayers of Luis Diaz are, I don't want to disrespect anyone, but people who look pretty much solely at numbers and go, well, his numbers don't stack up to Sadio Mane, don't stack up to Mo Salah, etc. But when you have Mo Salah firing all cylinders, you've got him scoring goals, doesn't matter. Likewise, Darwin Nunes, likewise, Diogo Jota. It's just when they're not there, and Diaz has to be your main guy. Not only has he got to be your main guy in terms of performance, which he so often is, but he also has to be the one sticking the ball in the back of the net. That becomes slightly problematic. Yeah. However, having said all of that, wonderful footballer.
Yeah. I mean, and look, Bobby Firmino's numbers don't stack up to Darwin Nunes' numbers.
No,
but no, we adore him. No one says that. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because that's not part and parcel of it, because he went to Sadio Mane stick. And it goes back to, I think it's dead right. I think he frustrates when he's picking the ball. And this is the problem, because we're saying that McAllister, it's a compliment to McAllister that we just want to give him the ball. Mm. And we want to give Trent the ball. And we wanted to give Thiago the ball. And we want to give Van Dijk the ball. Our back, like, sort of six, are desperate to pass the ball to Virgil van Dijk all the time. Well, you know what I mean? Like, Endo always just wants to give it to Van Dijk, because why wouldn't you? Because he's just going to pass it 40 yards up the pitch and get you in a different situation. you give the ball to Diaz because he knows how to handle himself. And you know he'll just hold on to it for a few minutes. You might be knackered and you just need to get out for a second and get your breath. Give it to Luis Diaz. But the problem is that Luis Diaz is picking the ball up on the halfway line, holding two men off, dribbling past one or two.
Twice.
And then what? You know, that's the point. He's miles away from actually having
he's
decisive
the
impact.
So often, though, isn't he? So often.
But Chloe, the two goals he scores at the weekend are exactly what you need to work Diaz into those situations. The goal that's not given against Tottenham Hotspur, you know, the goals disallowed at the weekend. You want him, get him in the box with the ball, and he'll score more often than not because he is good enough to do that.
Yeah, he is. And look, I go back to the first game of the season where he scored that goal, and I thought Sadio Mane. Then if you could do that a bit more, then unbelievable. Because he's got the qualities. He's the like you said. There, he's so good with the ball at his feet. He loves cutting inside and taking the shot, and he's had less opportunities for that because we don't have a flying fullback at the moment who's dragging a player out to get the space for Luis Diaz.
That needs fucking off a bit anyway, because if he could score 25 goals a season doing that, then Phil Coutinho would have been an absolute smash at every club that he was at.
But yeah, look, he's a brilliant footballer, and you know he's put himself through 120 minutes, 90 minutes, time after time after time, and got us over the line. His goal the other day was ridiculous. It's just like you said, he's on his toes, he's expecting it, he's anticipating it. Like I said, it was a Diogo Jota type of goal, and it very much felt like that. And if we can, you know, have Salah back, who hopefully will start getting into form, and when these chances fall at him, he'll score five instead of scoring one, then you don't need Luis Diaz to score. You just need to have him causing scenarios in which it leaves other players free, or he can do a give and go, or he can stretch the team.
We did the give and go with Salah, never got the ball back.
Yeah.
He should have got a goal there as well. Salah should have just played it across back.
He wasn't for going yesterday, Salah. The give bit was fine, it was the go that
just to segue this into a Salah chat, by the way, because look, no, it was funny because even like the Match of Day pundits are laughing, like he should be passing it. You got three strikers on the panel there going like, as if I'm never passing it. So I forgiving Mo Salah for not passing. But I did get that first hint. Darwin Núñez was raging with them all first half, because like Darwin's just done a stretch where he's been Liverpool's main man and people are passing the ball to him and he is sticking the ball in the back of the net, and all of a sudden it's a bit like, all right, yeah, we're back to this again where everything goes through Mo, and we could really do with Mo just scoring so that he can start turning to
exactly
create
the
game.
If he scores in the first minute, he gets six assists.
Yeah.
Problem whatsoever. Yeah. But I felt like Salah played in a different position yesterday to what we've seen recently. And I know we've not seen a lot of him. Obviously, the Match of the Day commentators mentioned it's his first start in the Premier League since New Year's Day, which is wild that we're still top of the table when we haven't had Mo for a full 3 months, by the way.
Yeah.
But like, he played a lot more inside and a lot more centre forward. And obviously, when Núñez goes off, he plays centre forward. But he was just a lot closer to the action. I don't know whether that was a shift by us.
Give the space to Bradley.
Yeah. Get him down that. You don't need to be there anymore,
man. Maybe that coincided with Bradley deciding, fuck this, I'm going to go forward, as opposed to trying to defend him being so
full. The McAllister thing, it all fits nicely, doesn't it? I mean, if you put Sobo there, right, you've got him wanting to get in there, you've got Salah wanting to get in there, you've got Conor Bradley wanting to get into the same space. Alexi can just sit back a little bit, watch the other two lads where they're going, and ping balls all over the place.
He had a big shot.
None of you listen to what I said there.
No idea.
Right, okay,
he's all thinking of jokes.
I think it's an interesting point because Salah starts very, very wide right for us, really hugging the touchline. But it's interesting that as the game goes on, it definitely works, because you're right, Salah starts putting in that inside channel, doesn't he? Yeah, just sort of the right hand side of the 18 yard box. That's where he's making his runs and entering the box and getting on the end of stuff. So yeah, great.
Can I just say though, back to the Luis Diaz thing, his dad isn't helping him out. His dad needs to shut up, to be perfectly honest, because we're in the middle of a title race here and you're talking about how you hope and you've still got hope that he's going to Barca or Real Madrid. Knock it on the head, lad, please. I'm loving you dancing and taking photos with all the opposition. Can get behind that. Rein it in for the next 3 months.
No, because it's an interesting point, because I randomly was thinking about this at the weekend, because I think like Fabrizio Romano was one of the first people to amplify those quotes. But then equally, once it had gone on a bit, he then amplified the notion of, don't worry about it too much. He was just asked the question by the South American press about this, and he was just answering that direct question, whereas we see it without out of context. It's like his dad's got into business for himself here in an old wrestling parlance of like, right, I'm going to take it upon myself to get my son this dream move, which isn't what happened. But it goes back to this notion of the problem with social media is Romano gets all the fucking clicks and engagement off this, and then when it dies down, he gets to do the flip side and get the clicks and engagement on the other side of it. And in reality, someone should have just come out straight off the bat and gone, here's what was said and why it was said and where it was said. But yeah, it's come out, his dad looks like a fucking massive bellend.
Next time you're asked about it, just turn around and say he's at Liverpool, please. Just do that. Just whilst in the summer, you can do whatever you want to do. But right now, whilst I'm trying to focus on trying to win a league title, just don't mention any other football.
There's a great thing I learned from doing the Jordan Henderson documentary, and I think this happens a lot for footballers, is that footballers tell their dads to stop talking to the press in certain situations, because dads can't help themselves, you know, when you because your pride outweighs all this thing, and it's probably just quite excited to talk about, you know. But of course, Barcelona wanted my son. Why would you? Yeah, I'd say
be mad not to.
Yeah, of course. The best clubs in Europe all wanted my son. Can we just talk about how amazing that is, by the way? Instead of thinking like, well, actually, this might be construed slightly differently in the social media age or whatever. No, but yeah, fair enough on that one. A couple of bits. Bradley and Quanta. We touched upon Bradley and how he really got better in the game. Jarrell Quanta. It was interesting, Chris, because in our Red Men group of all our contributors and whatever, I think Steve put like the leaked team in, and I think it was James Sutton went, "Oh, close to full strength that." And then I was like, "Cool." And then I looked at it and was like, we had Keller in goal, Bradley at right back, Quanta at centre half, Joe Gomez playing left back.
And yet James was right.
And yet he was right. But it goes to show, I had it said on a Totally Football podcast, both Bradley and Quanta, I think that's their seventh league start in their, basically, you know, in the Premier League, in their careers. At no point did any of us look at that team and go, oh Christ. And then even when they had a sticky start at the start of the half, in the first half, never really asked. And as by the time at the end of the game, I was just marvelling at the composure and brilliance.
Yeah, I think it's probably Jürgen's given them a nod of the cap there, because it's not often he'll start two young lads next to each other. You know, quite often if Kwanzaa's playing and Konate's playing, Kwanzaa will play the left, so the Konate will play the right, and sort of break the kids up around the back line. But I think the trust is there with both Bradley and Kwanzaa that he just goes, yeah, you sort your problems out. And I think you saw that. I think the first 30 minutes, I don't think either were very good. And the last 60, they were imperious, the two of them, and they were winning their battles. And if you win your battles, Steve Plunkett used to always say this, if you win your individual battles and everyone wins their individual battles, you go on and you'll win the game.
He's
and
not dead, by the way. He's fine.
Yeah, he's absolutely fine.
He's probably would still say
that.
He's not there. No.
So he's next to always say this.
God rest his
soul. Yeah. True enough. It was those, again, the persistent situations where you're thinking, because it was a nervy end of the game. There's no escaping it. I think we all felt a bit varying degrees of on edge about it. And the amount of times they continued to try and test us, putting the ball into the channel, over the top, pace, trying to chase things down. And not just getting there, but actually being strong and getting there and winning your battle, and then having the composure to play out from the back and actually choosing the moments just to stick it out of play as well.
There's times when Konza, I think he was in the sort of right back position, and he's not only winning it, he's not knocking the ball out of play, he's turning on it and passing. And you're like, wow, the composure this centre-half to be able to do that in what was a very high-pressure situation in terms of a league title, in terms of the game. And they never take they make the good decisions. There was a time when the ball got to Bradley at the back stick, and he just knocks it out for a corner. Just goes, that's the best thing to do.
Mm-hmm. And maturity, you know, there.
Yeah, and that's it. And they make the right decisions over and over.
There was a moment in that second half where the ball goes over Quanta's head and he kind of doesn't deal with it. And like, you think in that moment, oh my God, he's being done here. Like, he's you just being crap on the ball, and all of a sudden a nice little Cruyff turn here, see you later lad, you go that way, I'll get off this way. And it's like, the composure to not panic in that moment and rag the player back or bring him down or try and foul him. It was just the composure of, okay, I've been beaten, but I'm getting back and I'm winning the second battle instead. And it's ridiculous that we've got like teenagers playing at the back in a league title race and they're playing like this. Yeah. And the maturity of them in that second half, because like you mentioned, they struggled first 30. And in the second half, I hardly heard a peep out of Brighton from that side.
I'm in awe of the pair of them, to be honest with you. It's just sensational to watch. And you're right, Brighton did target that side in two ways about it. He had a Dingra running at him, and Conor Bradley spoke about how difficult that was.
He was good first there.
We speak a lot about Liverpool being able to solve problems in game and on the pitch and whilst it's going on. These two have got that. They're absolutely incredible. Seven stars. It's phenomenal. Like, how is this possible? Where have these come from? And they were both in League One last year. They're just sensational. But you're right, Quanta actually makes that situation tricky for himself because he doesn't get the first bit right, but he doesn't panic. He just goes, okay, I've messed up a little bit there, but it's fine. He essentially heads it to himself, holds off his man, shows a turn of speed to get in front again, turns him, and away we go. I mean, what more? He's 20 years old, and he's played like a handful of games. Frighteningly good.
Yeah, no, 100% on that. It's great. And again, just lasting on there, I think also the presence and brilliance of Virgil van Dijk helps a lot. I think the calmness of Kevin Kelleher at the back as well, McAllister, and even when Harvey Elliott comes on the pitch, just being that will and ball. Harvey Elliott, you know, he plays right-hand side, and I think those games are the perfect times to bring Harvey Elliott into the front three, not when you don't need his pace, when, you know, you're going to play against a team that's going to stick a load of men inside the 18-yard box, ask him to unpick, but he'll go back, he'll do all the dirty work for you as well. So actually, they've got the assurance in themselves of, I've only got to take one or two touches here, and then look, if it's nothing's on, I'll empty it. But in reality, if I come back inside, I've got Virgil there. If I have to go back, I've got Kelleher there. Both of them, I'll have it all day long. And then Alexis McAllister always makes himself available for it, and down the line later on again, Harvey Elliott. So yeah, brilliant. The way the team works, they allow us to have young players in there because they give them a platform, they give them the out ball constantly. If you leave them to their own devices, we could have sold all those players down the river, but no, I thought they were both, bro.
Was that speaking of Kelleher, from the cop, it looked like it was an incredible save from that header. Was it a good header?
Yeah. All
like,
I know about
save,
that,
sorry?
Right, is the goal looked four times bigger than a normal goal.
And the goal just got bigger and Keller was smaller. I was thinking, how is he going to save that?
And it was a good header. It looked a good save, but obviously we're the other end of the pitch and it kind of looked like it was going in slow-mo at the same time.
It wasn't good for my heart, I know that.
Yeah. No. It's one of those saves where the more you watch it back, the easier a save it looks. Looks like he gets down there quite comfortably by the end, right. But it's one of them, it's going towards the bottom corner and he's got to get down and get a good strong hand on it. Yeah, that, so really good.
The save from their keeper off Salah was probably the pick of the save.
That took a deflection as well.
It made it even harder. The Salah first time found the bottom corner, he actually, you know, apart from his actual finish, produced a good finish, but somehow he kept it out.
I don't remember this show.
Oh, Colin, it's a sensational save.
Yeah, I don't know when it was.
We worked it quite well. He was inside the 18-yard box, like probably just outside the six. He struck it well. Salah took a little nick off the defender on the way, and De Bruyne got down and tipped it wide.
Was this where it could have been 3-1?
Would have made it 3-1. Yeah, okay. It was brilliant.
Yeah, I remember
save.
That. Good
brilliant
save, yeah.
Anyway, if the goal could stop taking fucking Mario mushrooms when people are having shots, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the goal, it's like that the Jaws focus pull effect where like we panic and then it just gets bigger behind them. Right, Liverpool are top of the league.
Get it?
Yeah. We'll do more on this, of course, because obviously we're going to talk about the context around it with the City and Arsenal result that followed over on the Bias Football podcast later on. But I did think it was interesting. I saw a tweet, it came out last night, but I saw it this morning, from a guy called Gunnar Punner, who said, Liverpool comfortably third best in the league, and there's nothing their annoying fans can do to change that. Mercifully, we don't have to change that because we've got the players who've put Liverpool top of the league.
2 weeks ago, though. Wow.
But it did make me think about this, I've really been struggling to verbalise it, because like obviously City had Edison out and they had Walker out and Stones only fit enough to start on the bench, so they've had a few injuries. De Bruyne has missed half the season. Arsenal have had a few here and there, you know, throughout the season as well. Timber's missed the whole season, you're right. You know, a couple of fullbacks have had injuries and Zinchenko's missed a lot of footy. And I just feel like it's like people have stopped talking about it. And so, you know, again, it's because we've had a couple of injury rack seasons over the years, and eventually people just get bored of it and start cracking on, and how accepting we've been because of how brilliant we've been. But I just can't help but wonder. So I think I might do a little bit more on this on the next show, but for my own like visualization, like you know, it's mad when I did a chart for this, but a spreadsheet.
Excel.
I got an Excel spreadsheet. Well, you know, the Google one. Who's been missing in this sort of spell for us, and that 10 games post New Year thing, because it goes back to that Salah point of it was Salah's first start since New Year's Day, which is absolutely insane, and how many footballers we've been missing since then. And I kind of did it, and I drew up from Alisson, Matip, Konate, Trent, Robertson, Jones, Thiago for the sake of argument, Szoboszlai, Salah and Jota.
Good side.
Honestly, like, you know, I think that's nine lads who conceivably would start in a best 11 for Liverpool. You know, you could certainly make that case for most of them. And I know there'll be a few people going Thiago, but a year ago Thiago was in our best midfield. You know what I mean? I'm not, so I can happily make that case for him. And he also plays for us in this period of by the way. So he's not
15
just been,
minutes.
So yeah, 5 minutes at centre half. But it's actually that post the Arsenal game that I think is so interesting, because obviously we lose to Arsenal, and as that game finishes, we are 2 points ahead of them at the top of the league. City have got two games in hand over us and are only 5 points behind. So it's basically all handed to Man City. We've gone through that period. And then post Arsenal, since then, like, Alisson hasn't played a minute of football for us. Matip's been out that entire time. I think Konate's missed two games in that time, one through suspension. Trent has missed five of those six games since then. Thiago's missed all of them. Szoboszlai's missed three of those games. Salah's missed three of the games since then. Jota's missed four of them. And now the league table says we are still 2 points ahead of Arsenal, but we are now 3 points ahead of Manchester City. And I just can't imagine if we had two of those lads back in that period. Like, if we just had Trent and Jota, or Alisson and, you know, and Alisson and Jota, or Alisson and Trent, or, I mean, fuck me, Thiago and Matip. You know what I mean? I feel like Man City is still the best team in the league, intrinsically. And we say a lot, like, Arsenal are the best coach. They've got the most goals. They've got the best defensive record. And yet Liverpool are top of the league, having missed all of those footballers for this spell of time.
Can you bring the tweet back up for me? Do you mind? Because it's not something that I actually disagree about, the first sentence. Liverpool completed their best in the league. Sounds. The problem is the second part I have a problem with. And I was thinking about this after watching the City and Arsenal game and stuff, right? Is they're very metronomic, aren't they? They don't react to what's going on in the stadium, because, well, when you're building a side in empty stadiums, you've got to be metronomic. You've got to be absolutely excellent. I think it's like two fences, isn't it? They're the brilliant swordsmiths and all this type of stuff. But all of a sudden, you're going up against the fucking Jedi. You can use the light side and the dark side of the Force, and fury and love and emotion and fucking happiness and everything. That's what our stadium brings. We get angry when a decision goes against us. Liverpool tap into that fucking power and start fucking flying with the swords. And we get happy and Liverpool tap into that. So, yeah, we're not the best coach side, I don't think. I think Arsenal and City are absolutely superb. But we've got something they don't have, which is our fan base, and which is the power to react to what's going on around us. And they talk about momentum in sport, and a lot of people will tell you momentum doesn't exist in sport. Psychological momentum does exist, whether that's in sports or just in fucking real life. There's studies on it. Go and check them out if you're that way inclined. I didn't, for the sake of this chat. But that is what can happen, is how do you turn a negative result into a positive? Liverpool do it. We've proved that time and time again, because we've gone behind in games and we've won most points from going behind. Yeah. We use those negatives and we fuel ourselves from it and stuff like that. Whereas the other side don't react. They just keep doing the same thing they're doing and keep trusting that Guardiola and Arteta have coached them to a way where they're better than the opposition. Liverpool are the anti-Arsenal and the anti-Manchester City, who use everything around their surroundings, who might not be the best wielder of a sword, but when you've got the light side and the dark side of the force, who gives a flying fuck? Yeah. And that's why the fans and Anfield and what Jürgen Klopp has built within Liverpool Football Club and tapping into who we are have a great chance. It's why we're top. It doesn't matter who's out. We'll use it as fuel to the flames and we'll keep on fucking going. And we're going to win this fucking league and it's because of us.
That's the thing, is that like the underdog situation, I actually enjoy it. We're the only team, I think if it was Arsenal or like you saw it a couple of weeks ago where City played Liverpool and Liverpool absolutely battered City for the majority of that game, and Arsenal fans are sat there going, yeah, but we're more worried about City because it's actually us and City. Yeah, we're not worried about Liverpool, it's us and City. And it feels like yous have to be acknowledged as the best. Yeah. Where with Liverpool, I love that you think I'm an underdog. Yeah. I love that you never thought I had a chance, because what we're best at is being underdogs, because we're the ones who feel like everyone's against us and we use that. So I love the idea of being an underdog. I love being third best because it just means that we have much more of a say.
It goes back to it, again, because I don't disagree with any of the things. And yet at the same time, I'm just starting to like, it was like waking up on Monday morning and looking at going, how are we not the best coach team if we're able to deliver on what we're able to deliver on without three or four of our absolute, not just nailed on starters, but best in class in the world footballers in those given positions at times. How are we not a better overall team than Manchester City when we're able to, you know, they've not closed the gap. City haven't closed, they haven't done it, if anything. And this Arsenal, the supposedly brilliant team, and they have, by their own standards, they've come on leaps and bounds from this time a year ago, no doubt about it. And I'm happy for Liverpool to still continue to go under the radar. That's absolutely fine by me. But it was a little bit of like, and I'm still not convinced, because I'm not going to sit here and say Liverpool are definitely going to win the league now, because I don't in my heart of hearts truly believe it, because we shouldn't. But every week when it's supposed to come completely undone and crashing down, we just seem to find a way to keep going. And it's frightening to me, the idea that we might, in the next couple of weeks, get Trent Alexander-Arnold back in this team. And if it's only just him, I mean, what else can we do when we've got that available? If we get Alisson back at some point before the end of the season, if we got Diogo Jota back in at some point before the end of the season, again, Salah's back now. Just back. Yeah. And if we can get it, and he was so rusty, you can see by his performance levels. Adding
players of that ilk, calibre and stature, adding them back to the squad, seeing that as a bonus is quite frankly ridiculous. Like, it is hard to fathom where we find ourselves now, given what we've had not at our disposal in recent weeks. The list of names you just produced there is just ridiculous. You could add a couple more to that if you really wanted to as well.
Just for the argument's sake, Stefan Bicetic was playing every week for us this time of year.
And he was brilliant last year as well, so you really could stretch the parameters a little bit further. Yeah, but I'm with Chris. I think it's the intangibles that we possess that the other clubs, our rivals, aren't able to tap into, sets us apart from them, in my opinion. But yeah, in terms of, like you say, in terms of quality of team, in terms of quality of coaching, I don't have a real problem with what's been said there. But again, they don't have what we have. They will never have what we have in a lot of ways either. So I just think it's remarkable. And I, with Chloe as well, the way we go about it and the way we do it is just the best way, in my opinion. And the fact that all the noise this week in the build-up to the weekend was about the title, the side and the title race, but it was solely focused on Arsenal Man City, and like a winner-takes-all situation, or is the loser out of it, whilst it was there for all to see, because we were the other game. We were kind of like the other talking point, and we just went about our business, and nobody was putting any attention whatsoever on us. And I think you're right as well, we like that. Yeah. Whereas it feels like if people aren't talking about Arsenal, Manchester City, they're sort of take a front to that and go, well, hang on, what about us? We're not bothered.
Yeah. Also, by the way, I'm so sorry, but we're saving footy here, because when they both went head to head, that was the most boring game of football I've ever watched in my life.
To be discussed on the Bass Football Podcast. After this, head to redmenplus.com and check that show out, which we'll be doing shortly after we finish this one. Right, short break from us, then we're going to chat Liverpool's managerial options and Sheffield United as well in a bit.
Hello everyone, we've got an amazing competition prize for you this month. It is this incredible Liverpool away shirt from 04-05 signed by none other than goal scoring hero that season, Mr. Neil Mellor. Yes, if you want to be in the draw to win this, then head to redmenplus.com, sign up as a legend tier subscriber or upgrade from a captain tier and get your name in the hat at the end of the month for this wonderful signed Liverpool shirt. See you there.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Yes, get your name in the hat for that wonderful signed Liverpool shirt. Draw being done at the end of the month. Go to redmenplus.com, sign up as a legend tier subscriber, and get your name on the wheel of names in 4 weeks' time. Right, yes. Just, yeah, it's so funny. We had a very, very brief conversation there about, like, because last week on the Bias Footy Show, we were looking at the fixtures, the final 10, the run-in for us, Arsenal and City, and having a chat about the Champions League and all that. And then the more I think about it, the more... I'm not sure they will get past Bayern, but I just now want both of those teams to play as many games as they can and just let them slug it out amongst themselves. But yeah, we'll do more on that. I'm biased. Anyway, right, Chris, Xabier Alonso has reaffirmed his commitment to Bayer Leverkusen. He won't be leaving them in the summer. Takes himself, therefore, out of the running for the Liverpool-Bayern. Certainly jobs this summer and potentially Real Madrid as well. I think months ago when this came out, I think the only other ideal circumstance other than him joining as Liverpool manager was I said I'd respect him if he stayed at Bayer. Because, look, he's doing an amazing job with them and it actually speaks to his character as well, actually being able to stick it out when you've got a good thing going. So in that regard, it did take the edge a little bit off it for me. But how did you feel about the overall situation?
Gutted, because I do think he's the class candidate, to be honest with you. The absolute perfect fit for Liverpool Football Club, and I don't see the others as being perfect. That doesn't mean they can't succeed, doesn't mean I won't get behind them. It just means I'm disappointed that Xabi Alonso won't be Liverpool manager next season.
Yeah.
And it means I'll be really pissed off next year when he signs for Real Madrid. And I know that the international break where he took a little bit of the time to think about what his future held meant he got tapped up by Real Madrid and it all got organised and stuff like that. So now I am absolutely gutted about it, but a Liverpool Football Club. We're Liverpool Football Club fans, so we'll just crack on regardless and without Zabi and prove that it can be done another way, because it's what we've always done, isn't it?
Yeah. Chloe, how are you doing?
I mean, he was the one that everyone had set their dreams on, isn't it? It was kind of, we'd put ourselves in the position where it was him or it was absolutely nothing, because you just felt gutted by it. I think it's a risk for him, just in terms of, not in terms of what he's doing, because I actually think, you know, it actually might help him. But this was your chance to be Liverpool manager, and I'm not sure it comes around again for another 8 to 10 years, to Possibly. Be perfectly honest. If things go well,
hopefully, yeah. Someone's doing something right.
Then, you know, and even then, in a couple of years' time, the thing is, I don't think you could ever go to Bayern Munich then, because I think you're going to ruin everything that you've done at Bayer Leverkusen, no matter how many years you stay there.
If you could just ruin Bayern Munich, that would be enough, though. Yeah. That would soften the blow, wouldn't it?
But, you know, the Real Madrid and Bayern jobs come around more often than a Liverpool one, and I think that was the most gutting, is the fact that actually, who knows if he'll ever become Liverpool manager, because it felt like that was the time. He's young, he's exciting, he's what is the next best thing in everyone's minds. But at the same time, he's chose not to come to us, so that's fine. I'll crack on without you, and I'll hopefully do better than you.
It does make you think, sorry to interrupt there, Chloe, it does make you think that Liverpool were looking at the right guy, though, doesn't it? In the same, you know, sort of what you're saying is like, you know, would Jürgen maybe have left after winning one Bundesliga title? I don't think he probably
there's
would.
There's some integrity there, isn't
there? Isn't there? And there's a belief in what he's doing. And, you know, he might look at it and go, well, I'm still the only side in Europe that's undefeated. Maybe to win a Champions League, the best place I could be is Leverkusen. Because people are going to want to go and want to play for him. His star's shining pretty brightly at the moment. He's proved that he can take a team and turn them probably into league champions and, you know, go quite far in Europe. Maybe he wants that experience to fall back on before he has the intense limelight of a huge job. There's so much to respect from his decision. There's so much to hate from his decision at the same time.
The thing is what, like, you look at it, and if he wins, obviously they're the big team in the DFB Poker. Yes, that's
they'll
it.
They'll win that, by the way.
If they win the double, and look, I hope they don't, but they could win the Europa League as well. Like, what else can he improve on? Next year might actually be a disappointing year for you if you can't replicate
also, I get that, right? Yeah. But, like, what if you can build another side? In Germany and become a European superpower? For all the stuff that Guardiola's done in his career, and he's achieved a hell of a lot in terms of trophies, he doesn't have that. You built a team up and conquered Europe. Like, is that what he wants? Because that might be it, and he's at the perfect club for that.
I think more likely what he wants is Champions League experience. Champions League experience under his belt. I think Chris was right in your initial thing of, like, it's the spotlight thing. Liverpool, Real Madrid and Bayern Munich are just huge football clubs. They're the final bosses. That's where you want to end up at, what a club, and probably not even Bayern, if we're being honest. You know what I mean? Because it is, it's a bit...
There's six managers in 4 years or something.
It's a hard to fail at Bayern Munich, isn't it, to some extent as well. But the...
Hi, Harry.
Well, he's doing all right, isn't he?
He's doing all right.
Personally, that's all Harry cares about.
It's the Cristiano Ronaldo effect. But yeah, there is something to, like, you know, you need to know how to conduct yourself when you're playing two games a week and they're of the highest level, and you're now going to be expected next season to challenge for the title again, whilst also making a good fist of the Champions League as well. So there is a little bit to that. If we were choosing our ideal Liverpool candidate, Dan, we'd want someone who's got that as well. And that's kind of the problem with all of this, is that Alonso felt like the best of the lot. But I wouldn't have been looking around. When I think about when we've gone for managers in the past, we've been a bit... Rafa Benitez changed the game for us, I think, because, you know, we were forever linked with Alan Kerbyshley's of this world, and, you know, good English lads or whatever, you know, around that. You know, even like Ule coming in, didn't come in with an amazing track record of being a club manager. I don't think he really even had a record, to be honest. He was very wildly criticised for his hand in France not qualifying for the World Cup in 1994 as well. But all of a sudden, Benitez came in as there was two hot managerial prospects. Mourinho had won the European Cup. Benitez had won the UEFA Cup. Rafa had a better domestic record because he'd won a better league with Valencia in Spain. Mourinho had obviously dominated with Porto in the Portuguese league. Klopp was another one who challenged, you know, broken hegemony of Bayern Munich, made a good fist of Europe as well. If you were handpicking it, Alonso still is a little green for the Liverpool job. But at the same notion, there's not like anyone else out there is really pulling up trees as the obvious candidate.
No, that's it, isn't it? Yeah, and I think you're absolutely spot on. That was the only real drawback. Everyone I spoke to in the round, it, people that knew him, people that played for him, with him, that was the only thing you could ever really put in the cons list, is the fact that he was a little bit lacking in experience. Obviously, where else should that be? And 18 months into what is a so far a wonderful job at Bayer Leverkusen. But you're right, in an ideal world, you would have that extra 12 months, that Champions League football box ticked. But Liverpool aren't living in an ideal world, because in an ideal world, Jürgen Klopp wouldn't be leaving, and we'd be having his conversation 2 years, 18 months down the line, and then Xabi Alonso would have that experience. It'd be a completely different landscape.
But so, for all of that one con, yeah, he's done it as a player.
No, that was my
that was
thing.
The other thing, yeah, isn't it? He's done it as a World Cup winner, Euros winner, Champions League winner, won different leagues.
He's played under a who's who of football managers as well, so he will have tapped into their experience along the way. So even that con, all of a sudden, when you look at it and you really unpick, you think, okay, well, that's not even that bad a thing anyway, because you're right, he's been there, he's done it, he's seen it as a player, so it's a completely different conversation. But yeah, I can't really begrudge him his decision to stay. I think had we been sat here and going, oh, he's chosen Bayern Munich or he's chosen Real Madrid, I'd be furious and disappointed as it is, because again, I think he was the man for the job. I think the stars felt like they'd aligned, and albeit the timing's far from perfect, he is definitely the one I would have wanted. So yeah, definitely a little bit gutted by it all. Do I think that's the end of us? No. Far from it. Do I think we'll be fine? Yeah, I do. And also, I will say this, as much as I love Xabi Alonso and I think his managerial credentials, his trajectory is very much pointing in the right direction. And again, I think it's probably a smart decision for him to stick around, because it might have been a bit of a jump too soon for him to make that leap. So credit to him for that. I think I want the manager at Liverpool Football Club who's going to walk through hell and high water to be the manager at Liverpool Football Club. Yes. And Xabi Alonso clearly isn't that right now. Mm-hmm. So again, when I kind of remove the emotion and detach myself from the romanticism of it being Xabi Alonso, I think, okay, fine. And I also do wonder whether Michael Edwards is that thing whereby they say you take emotion out of decisions. He's going to take emotion out of this decision, so we will get the best man for the job. And maybe that wasn't Xabi Alonso, but yeah, for all intents and purposes, when you look at the connection and the data, he might well have been that.
Yeah. There's also a case of he doesn't come across as that type of man, but he actually might also be intimidated by the fact that Jürgen Klopp, like, we keep talking about, you know, it would be a dream, because it's the Liverpool manager. It's being, you know, the manager of one of the greatest football clubs in world football.
Well, we see it as the pinnacle.
That's what we see it as, yeah. But it also, I guess, it can be intimidating. You've got a really good crop of players there, and you've got to come in and somehow hit the ground running. And maybe he did see it a little bit as that's actually a little bit too intimidating for this early on. And he might have looked at Gerrard, and no way am I comparing those two careers, by the way, in terms of managerial careers. But Steven Gerrard jumped at the quick opportunity, because he thought, I might never get another Premier League team, and he jumped, and now he's over managing Etifak, who sit middle of the table in a crap league. Like, that's just what happened. So maybe he was slightly intimidated by
it. Does
the
feel like he's got a plan
it.
For his managerial yeah. career, and it's one that you're probably right, because maybe this wasn't part of the plan and yeah. he's sticking to it.
I mean, yeah. before, look, I mean, Jürgen was asked about it pre-match, wasn't he? You know, there's no way Jürgen Klopp wasn't getting offers from like year one at Dortmund onwards, you know what I mean, year two Dortmund onwards. He'd have been having all kinds of people knocking on the door going, do you fancy it,
but you know, Bayern wanted him for the longest,
you know,
time.
He's having a good time at Bayer Leverkusen. He settled in, you know. I was reading stuff saying he didn't particularly want the Sociedad job originally. He then stuck it out longer at Sociedad when he was offered a job a season earlier in that one as well, because he wanted to continue to make sure he got this stuff under his belt. And ultimately, it might put down to it, because it's hard for us to imagine this, because it's very anti-modern football, but he might just really enjoy his life. He might just be like, you know, he might just be settled. His family might be happy. He really like who he's working with and all that kind of stuff. And he's about to win the league. And he might think, well, why can't I go? Because we're all going, well, what if it goes wrong? Elite people don't think that way. It might. And it might be that moment. You know, we might be looking at, it might be a Gerrard moment where he's missed his window of opportunity. And then the wheels all come off next year. Bayern Munich just throw a load of money at the problem. And all of a sudden they steamroll you into the ground like they always do. And that looked like a stupid move. But what I said to this is, like, you've got to own the big moves in your life. And as galling as it is, because I think we'd all choose Liverpool, because of course we would. I don't think this is anything to do with how much he does or doesn't love Liverpool. He's obviously got a connection with Liverpool, but he clearly has a connection with Bayern and Real Madrid as well, to be expected. So yeah, I respect it. I don't like it, but I can empathise. I can respect that. Where it leaves us is my major concern over this is that I look at who's left. And where it was, I said this weeks ago on this, is that Alonso just had carried with him an aura that I think would have allowed us to all take a big deep breath in what we're doing and what we're coming. And I look at what's left, and it goes back to this thing of when you go for Jurgen Klopp, he's a guy who's exceeded expectations in the Bundesliga with a team that's not expected to win the league and not meant to, you know, it's meant to challenge and be there or thereabouts, but it's telling Dortmund haven't come close, you know, been that good since Klopp left. Again, Rafa Benitez just breaks down Real Madrid and Barcelona with the third best team, a team that he makes the third best team and then the best team in La Liga.
I mean, Depo were there all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And then I look at what's on the table now, and Ruben Amorim now is the standout candidate in terms of at least what he's done. But we're talking about a guy who's won one Premier League title. You know, we're not even talking a top five league in Europe by all accounts. He's had a bit of domestic success. He played a lot of games at domestic level in the Portuguese league as well. So he's got something going for him. Chris, he's done a lot more on style of play and all that kind of stuff, and he feels like he would be a good fit. But it's another that you. He's just got no experience outside of Portugal to speak of. And his success at Portugal hasn't been... He's not the next Mourinho. He's not going to win a Champions League while he's been there or whatever. And then you're looking at De Zerbi, and there's a guy who's had, you know, a reasonably successful season with Shakhtar. He's done good things, taking lesser lights in Italy and made them a bit competitive in a good style of football, but nothing you'd say immediately translates to Liverpool. Thomas Frank's done nothing. And I'm starting to look around and go, everyone now feels there's a degree of gamble with every manager. And that would be even if you were getting Carlo Ancelotti in as Liverpool manager to follow Jurgen Klopp, by the way. But that's where I'm at now. I'm wary of stepping into this arena of speculation because I don't think anyone's the right fit, and I'm running a risk of going, I don't think he's good enough or good enough or good enough, and we're probably going to end up with one of these guys who is, in inverted commas, not good enough. So this is the wilderness we're at right now. If you had to pick
Amorim, mainly because, and I said this last week on a deep dive with Josh, I actually thought if you were taking the tactics that the team plays currently and moving it to Liverpool, then his tactics fit best with Liverpool's, more so than Alonso. But we were talking on the way to the match yesterday, I was sort of saying, like, well, there's no guarantee that Alonso uses the tactics he's used at Leverkusen at Liverpool, because you make your tactics based on the players that you've got in your squad. So basing it purely on Alonso's Bayern side and Amorim's Sporting side, I think his tactics fit better. I think he's a better manager probably than the others that we're talking about. Nagelsmann's obviously, I think, a very, very good candidate, that the timing of doesn't work for me because of the Euros and all that being in Germany and pre-season starting and all that type of stuff. But I like Amorim, and I think the one thing that you have to look at, and you know, again, stuff that I've sort of spoken to people about and read about, is that, you know, looking for a manager, according to Ian Graham, is the holy grail of analytics. It's very difficult to find how much an impact a manager has on a team. But with all the names that we're mentioning, you can look at the manager as having a big impact on the team. And then you get started down these sort of rabbit holes of, well, is the European experience and all this type of stuff. Well, sometimes you've got to learn on the job, unfortunately. And I think with the candidates that we've got, would you rather have a European experienced manager who's just not very good, or a really good manager who doesn't have the European experience? I know where I'd sit. I'd rather the good manager who's, you know, unfortunately I don't want them learning on the job, but if they're the best candidates because they're the best managers, you kind of got to go, okay, fine.
This is something to a manager, I think, Dan, who can, you know, because we've had this all the time. It's what David Moyes suffered with when he took the Manchester United job, is he was turning around to a bunch of guys who won absolutely everything and going, right, listen, lads, I know what you're doing here, but what I'm saying is, when I had, you know, Phil Jagielka and, you know, and Leighton Baines and Nigel Martin in goal, you know, and we were really scrapping for a top half finish with Everton. This is what we did. And it's like Ryan Giggs or whatever type people are going like
4-4-2. That's what we did at Manchester United.
Yeah, great. Having someone who can at least call upon when I did this, you know what I mean? I've got a tangible. When I won this, this is how I went about achieving it. Achieving it is a little bit of a barrier to entry for me.
Yeah, there it is. Absolutely, it is. Yeah, and I suppose that's where the personality has to shine through more than ever, and that ability to be a leader and ability to be a manager has to transcend what's gone before, I guess. And in all accounts, you know, Amorim has that, and what he has done as well, which I'll kind of come back to, is like, he has upset the natural order a little bit in Portugal. They, Sporting, albeit one of the clubs in Portugal, of course, they weren't necessarily serial winners of that league. I think far from. I think they won it like the first time in 19 years. So he's got that under his belt. You know what I mean? So I'm okay with it. Do I think it's ideal? No, but I don't think Liverpool live in an ideal world once again. We're not exactly awash with candidates to go, it has to be him, has to be him. It feels like Amorim is definitely the next best. It's felt like that throughout this entire process. It was some drop, by the way, from Alonso to Amorim, but I believe it's some drop again to the rest of the candidates. I think they're all in a pool swilling around somewhere below him. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think in an ideal world, they would have to look what I've won, playing career, managerial career, whatever it may be, look what I did. And the players instantly have that respect. You know who he is coming through the door, et cetera, et cetera. I think that'd be perfect. Does he possess that? No. But does he have the personality, the character, the charisma, the leadership, the managerial qualities to make that not matter? Quite possibly. I mean, look at Jurgen Klopp. Like, his playing career was hardly outstanding. Obviously, don't get wrong, what he did as a manager before he got to Liverpool stood him in good enough stead in that elite category for players to instantly respect him. But at some point at Dortmund, and indeed Mainz to a certain extent, he would have had to convince players that what he was saying they had to get behind because he didn't have the playing career to stack it up. So it's not necessarily the be-all and end-all, is kind of what I'm trying to
say. It's easier to do that, though, at clubs that have lower expectations.
100%. Yeah, 100%.
Just lastly, Chloe, just for, it does, for me, this now poses the question of, are we not, is it worth revisiting Pep Linders as a conversation? Now,
what's he won?
But he's been there while, but he has at least been
there. Amorim worked for Mourinho, fucking won loads.
Pep Linders, to me, feels like a stopgap waiting for Alonso.
Yeah, and that's a conversation I think is a worthwhile conversation at this point, because if your number one choice, Liverpool don't buy centre halves on a number one choice, centre halves not available, and God knows how many other times, you've got Pep there who gives you that, you know, yeah, and also he's not going to cost you loads of money, you know, because he's probably still got a contract if we really wanted to hold him to it or whatever. There's a continuity aspect there that he knows what the insides and outs of the football club. It does make me think, you know, because again, and do you think, for in your opinion, is he in that same sort of pool that De Zerbi and Thomas Frank, for example, inhabit?
No, he's higher than them, because what I'm looking at right now is someone who I can buy into as a manager. That is the most important thing for me right now. And I'm so sorry to say it, but De Zerbi, there is just something about that man that I just can't. Like, if he was on the touchline for Liverpool, and bear in mind, if he does, I'm going to have to get behind him and probably support him, and I will. But there's just something about him that I just can't get on board with, and I cannot pinpoint it at all. Like, I physically have thought about this for months, and I cannot understand what it is. I just don't like it. There's just something that I'm not getting on with there. Like,
it's,
I don't
the
know.
It might be the hair gel.
With Amorim, there's a character there that I can buy into. There's passion exactly there, yeah. That. There's the fact that, you know, he's done it with a club who were sleeping giants in the likes of Sporting, and Liverpool were once there, and Jurgen Klopp kind of did that. And there is just something more that I can grasp onto, and I can turn around and say, yeah, absolutely, I can get behind that lad. I can buy into what he wants me to do as a fan. And I could do that instantly with Jurgen Klopp. What I will say with the Pep Linders thing is, once again, Thomas Frank, there's something about it. I do not like it, and I do not want it. Pep Linders is above them two for me, just because he is someone who I've been able to buy into alongside Jurgen Klopp. It wouldn't be my answer, because there's just, like you said, there's a stopgap. And to be perfectly honest, he doesn't deserve that. He's got potentially Ajax lining him up here. He deserves to have a go at being a manager and having a go at trying to bring them success. And I'm not sure he could do that at Liverpool. He needs, I think it was you mentioned earlier, he's got no backroom staff. His backroom staff are Jurgen's staff, who are all just getting off. And we don't know how he'll work on his own. We know how he worked with Jurgen Klopp. He's a much more senior man who's done it before. We know what it was like when he had someone who was more superior above him. We don't know what he's like on his own. So yeah, it's a tough one to understand.
Plus he's changed, hasn't it, significantly? Before I do the obvious of saying, like, you know, the guy, you know, Bob Paisley had no managerial experience, yeah. And Joe Fagan had no managerial experience, and Kenny Dalglish had no managerial experience, and were able to come in and continue the ball rolling. And there is a little bit, and that's what I mean. This is an interesting conversation that's going to follow. It feels like he's just been completely bombed out of the running, and there must be some reasoning behind that. We've heard him say he always said he'd leave when Jurgen left. Yeah. Does he himself feel like he's not ready to take the top job? We don't know. We don't know the truth behind any of this, because it felt for years. My immediate thought when that Jurgen Klopp video dropped, I was walking back to ours, trying to fathom it all out with tears in my eyes, and my immediate reaction was, "Cool, we'll just give it to Pep, and that'll be." And I could immediately make my peace with that. But for that to be instantly taken away. It's mad, isn't it? Because I agree with Chloe on this. It's like, what makes me feel more comforted, and my level of comfort has got nothing to do really ultimately with this, because there's smarter people with more data points and all these kind of things going on who know more behind the scenes and the stories. It might be that no one likes him behind the scenes, and they might not want him. They might be itching to just have a clean break, because you hear loads of stuff about him and Jurgen and all that kind of stuff, don't you, about how they can be quite spiky characters or whatever within it. I don't know, it's pure speculation at this point.
So it's so unique, the Liverpool job, isn't it? We essentially touched on this earlier on when we talked about how well coached Man City and Arsenal are. We need to be well coached, of course. We're doing tactics and systems and all that sort of stuff, absolutely imperative. That's why systematically I think Amorim's a fit as well, but we require so much more than that. You've got to buy in, you've got to understand what it means to manage a football club. There has to be that motivational side of things. That's not to say other managers don't possess that, of course, and other clubs don't need that as well, but I think we are so unique in what we want and what we demand. I mean, we want somebody who can come in and motivate the players, and also the fans can get behind. It just feels very different to me. We don't want this sort of run of the mill, he's brilliant at tactics and that's fine. I'm with you on the Deserby stuff. I've made, you know, no secret of that whatsoever, certainly upstairs. There's something intangible with De Zerbi that I can't get behind. There's something missing there, and I don't think we'd ever gain that connection. And listen, I'm with you. If he does become the manager, I'll have to buy into him, I'll have to get behind him, and I'll back him to the hilt. Of course I will. But there's something about the way he goes about his business, it doesn't sit right with me. And I think on top of that, his comments over the weekend about wanting to get out of Brighton doesn't feel right either. Klopp's been the opposite of that. His communication skills have been wonderful. He's always said the right things at the right time. I don't think De Zerbi has. So managing Liverpool Football Club, to sort of round off the point, is more than just being a football manager. We've seen that in Jurgen Klopp's entire reign, and nobody can come in and emulate that. It's nigh on impossible. But somebody has to get close to that for me, and at least have similar sort of beliefs and similar sort of ways of going about the business. And not many in this conversation tick those boxes, unfortunately. That's why Alonso was so perfect. I just think Amorim's the next best by some distance.
Yeah. Mm. And like you said there, Jurgen, what he's done is, he's came in and he's felt like, actually, he's from the city of Liverpool. He could have been a Scouser. Yeah, like, it, for every moral, everything that he's came out on, and he has been proactive on things. He's gone out of the way to make sure that community is spoken out for. He's just, his proper sound, he seems
just
boss.
Just on this, though, by the way, just Rafa Benitez ended up being a wonderful fit as Liverpool manager.
Yeah, of course.
But didn't, I mean, is a guy who very rarely leaves a football club in any sort of positive way. I mean, fucking Valencia airbrushed him out of, like, title-winning photos and stuff when he left that club. He had mad issues with them. He's had loads of stuff along the way. He's not a particularly loving sort of guy, not a huge, you know, gregarious character like Klopp and whatever. But we took him to our heart. I'm sure we can, you know, people need the opportunity to be exposed to Liverpool.
Winning masks it all. That's the big thing. I had real problems with Brendan Rodgers being the Liverpool manager before he was given the Liverpool manager's job. And in 13-14, he was the greatest manager we've had for 20-odd years.
But we weren't just coming out of Klopp either, were we?
No, of course. And that's different. And that's why it's interesting for me, the Pep Linders stuff, is because he's clearly a brilliant football coach. But if you're going to sit here and tell me that you're worried about Amorim because he's only won the fifth best league in Europe, which it is officially one of the top five now above France. Yeah, it was a couple of years ago they changed that. And he's won a league title after 19 years for a side that hadn't done it. Then I've got concerns over Pep Linders for his one failed attempt at management.
Yeah.
You know, and listen, don't get me wrong, I think Pep Linders could be a great manager. I really do. I don't know how he'd react, but I'd have to see that in front of the press week in, week out. But what you've got to go on past successes or failures and stuff when you're looking for a Liverpool manager. And I think Liverpool's setup would be better for him than it is under Jurgen Klopp.
Yeah.
Because they are essentially looking for a head coach now. They're not looking for a football manager.
Yeah.
But equally, Pep Linders is the coach of the team. Mm. He doesn't make the big decisions. He coaches what Jurgen asks him to coach, and he has a big part of how we play and stuff like that. But what happens when you're the man who's making the decisions? That's when it can go wrong. So I think you need to look for managers nowadays, or teams, sorry, head coaches who've run it, and their decisions are the be-all and end-all when you're looking for a job of the magnitude of Liverpool Football Club.
Can I also just say that, like, Jurgen Klopp's been the manager of Liverpool for pretty much a third of my life. So, like, where yous are all sat here talking about Rafa Benitez and all that, I was three or four when he won a Champions League. Yeah, so literally, so like, this is actually,
you know, 27 all of a sudden.
Yeah, no, not even a third. But like, it's but that's what I mean. Like, I don't, I've not really known any different. So when I think about the
because it wasn't very good for
years long. You're a misfortune.
But when I think of like the things I can grasp onto for the, you know, this is the longest manager in my career, in my life. Like, I'm gonna try and grasp onto the fact of how I felt with a manager who really I could buy into, and that is what I'm going to hold on to.
It's just that thing of Pep Guardiola doesn't look like he's going anywhere anytime soon, unless City get absolutely shagged everywhere by PSR. But we'll see. Arteta looks like he's in it for, you know, for a good old run at the moment, and I just wonder whether this, you know, we're now in that world now, because that was my assurance this whole time. Every time a good football club got a new manager, I was like, there's Jurgen Klopp and there's Pep Guardiola, and everyone else is underneath, and now we're shopping in that pool like mere mortals, you know. And we're gonna have to do this when we have to go and buy Salah's replacement. We're gonna have to go and find the world where the guy who plays on that right hand side might score loads of goals or might get loads of assists, but he's not gonna do both because it's impossible to buy someone, basically, because it's such a small margin. We're going to have to replace Van Dijk at some point, Trent at some point, and Alisson at some point, and we're going to have to deal with just having really, really good instead of like best in the history of all time kind of levels. And that's just bad. And that goes back to this thing about Jurgen Klopp taking this decision now. All the respect in the world to him for knowing himself and all that, but I'm not going to sit here and tell you that there's no way that it can be as good. And anything can be good, by the way, and it's got a possibility. But when you're dealing in probabilities, like, we're going to have to enter into a mad world where there is no one who does, you know, because this feelings thing's too big. Like, I want it, when that guy still goes toe to toe and shakes hands with Pep Guardiola, Klopp's won because I know he could beat him in a fight. Sounds stupid, doesn't it? But like, obviously Jurgen Klopp could kick Pep Guardiola's head in, and that matters to me weirdly, you know what I mean? Whereas I look at the Zerbi walking into them and going, I think Arteta might be, I know he's a little scrappy.
This is why CEOs are all over 6 foot in some of the biggest companies in the world, you know. There's a mad thing on it, isn't there? There's just no respect there for a 5'9" lad, unfortunately.
But it's mad, isn't it? Because there's a lot of moving parts and things like that. I don't want to consider a world where we've got to revisit this in a year or in 2 years' time, because that means that we've had to go through 2 years of Liverpool being so crap that we need to consider the manager's position again, which is a bit mad. Because there's a world where Pep goes away and does Ajax, Jordan Henderson maybe comes under his wing as like an assistant manager. I know Jordan Henderson's not, you know, flavour of the month on our major side, but whatever, you know, you could see them being at something like down the line. I always thought Milner would come back as some sort of like assistant down the line to Pep. That would be a possibility. It's too many unknowns at this point.
To roll it back to the Pep Linders stuff, like, Arteta is essentially the Pep Linders at Arsenal at the moment. He hadn't had a number one job.
Yeah.
Takes a bit of time, but has absolutely proved that he's a world-class manager. And, you know, equally, Guardiola had no management experience before he basically started winning every trophy every single year.
Yeah.
You know, the football football is littered with managers who come into big football clubs and start winning, or coaches who become managers and start winning. And Xabi Alonso is another one of those, isn't he, really, to be fair to him? He's now the best. We're a year and a half away from everyone thinking Gerrard was going to be the next manager of Liverpool Football Club, and Xabi Alonso is the guy that we're gutted about now, who hadn't even started his managerial journey then. Yeah. So for all the, you know, the feelings of guilt and, I don't know, disappointment that you're feeling, something can just pop up out of nowhere and be the right thing.
Yeah, that's it. And it's just a little battle thing. I'm long enough in the tooth to know that when you've got somewhat, having a world-class goalie, a world-class centre-half, a world-class goal scorer, and a world-class manager, you can try and you can throw all the money in the world at those positions, but you just get them wrong for a variety of circumstances. Manchester United have been trying to replace Alex Ferguson for a decade, and they haven't deliberately got it wrong. They've just got it wrong. You know, like Chelsea have tried a million times in a variety of different ways and gotten things. Sometimes they get it right, sometimes they get it wrong. Arsenal got it wrong a bit in the Wenger thing. They got it wrong by keeping Wenger around for so long, then got it the wrong fit along the way. And for the best will in the world, you can bring guys in, it just doesn't work. There was no ill intent behind bringing Roy Hodgson in as Liverpool manager. Somebody looked at his at what he had going and went, he should be able to do a decent job as Liverpool boss.
Yeah, Kenny Dalglish came in. Polish finished top half one season.
Well, yeah, you know, he got to the Europa League final and everyone went, okay, that's a promising thing. Looking at what we've got now, Andoni Iraola is like the new Roy Hodgson in terms of that, isn't he? Because that's what he's got on his sort of CV. It's wild, and that's the problem about Jürgen Klopp, is he's too big and too good at too many things.
I thought this was supposed to be a happy podcast and we were top of the table, because now I'm just depressed.
Before. Yeah. Sorry, we've run out of time. We'll do happy stuff as well.
It was a bit like yesterday's game. We were brilliant first half and second half, we let them back into it.
But yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting stuff, and this is where we're at. This is the conversation point moving forward, isn't it? It's hanging over our head. The good thing is we've got Jürgen Klopp for another 9 league games, bare minimum, a maximum 14 more football matches. So yeah, let's soak that up while we can, because yeah, it's going to be a wild ride.
And also, as Chloe said, we're top of the table.
Yeah. Sheffield United up next. We haven't got time to go into that one, so do check out the match preview, which will be out on Wednesday. Steve's going to be hosting that, and we'll probably have a little chat about it on Bias Footy Pod just to make up for it. So come and join us over on Redmen Plus for that one, where yes, the Liverpool are top of the table positivity chat will continue, because we get to laugh. We're going to laugh at Man United, we're going to laugh at Everton, and we're going to laugh at all the Arsenal fans, absolutely like pigs and shit over the moon, because they basically lost top spot in the Premier League by playing dour football. Check us out. Thank you so much for watching, for listening, and we'll be back with another Redmen Originals podcast next week. Ta-ra.